Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I don't know about you, but we're getting slammed with Stella, and I'm not very fond of her. She's dumping us about 2 feet of snow, but that's okay because then you can come and listen to my show and enjoy my on-air interview with Terry Chams. We're going to talk about Unsettling Crime for Samuel Craddock, and he happens to be one of my favorite characters. I've read and reviewed every single one of her books. She's an award-winning author of the series, and one of my favorites was The Necessary Murder of Noni Blake. When the Jarrett County Fire Department is called to douse a fire on the outskirts of the town, they discover a grisly scene. 5 young black people have been murdered. This was horrible. A newly appointed chief of police, Samuel Craddock, just back from a stint in the Air Force, finds himself an outsider in the investigation headed by the Texas Highway Patrol. Now, he's a really cool character, but they don't really want him in the job. But he takes it anyway. He takes an immediate dislike to John Sutherland, so did I, a racist trooper who seems to be jumping to conclusion about the case. But I'm not going to say anymore. I'm going to let the author, Terry Chams. Good morning. How are you? And I'm
good morning.
Not sure it's gorgeous. Hi. So, tell us, summarize the plot. This is the prequel to the Samuel Craddock series. How come you decided to write that now and share it with
us?
When
I first published the first book, which was The Killing at Cotton Hill, my editor said to me, you know, I'd love to have a prequel sometime because I'd like to know how Samuel got to be who he got to be. So I just kept going along and thinking, well, you know, I'm not quite ready to write it, And then all of a sudden I said, you know, I think it's time. There have been 5 books, and people have gotten to know him, and it's time to write the prequel now. So there was nothing esoteric about it. I just decided it was time. And my editor wanted it, too.
Oh, really? So tell us about Samuel Craddock and his role as police chief and why he decided to take it, because a lot of people thought that he would fail, and, of course, we're not going to let that happen.
Well, the thing is that he, like a lot of people, it was aimless after he got out of college. He went to Texas A&M. And after he got out of college and the Air Force, he went to the Air Force so he could pay for college, because his parents couldn't afford to send him to college, so the Air Force would. So he went into the Air Force and then went on to college. And when he got back, he had married, and he and his wife decided to go back to the town where he lived. She was from Dallas and didn't want to live in a big city. She wanted to live in the small town. She wanted small town life, which is a nice life. She just had it with the city. They moved back there, and the city council asked him if he would step into the job of chief of police, because they wanted a young person because they had a little drug problem. And a lot of towns did. This was back in 1982. And a lot of places did have little drug problems. And they said they thought that a young man would be able to deal with that. And he said, on a lark, well, yeah, how much trouble could there be in a small town of 3,000 people? Well, he found out. So that's why he took the job. It was sort of just a lark.
Yeah, well, he did a good job, but he got into had no problem. So there are many issues that come to light in this novel, such as guilt by the color of your skin, which I don't tolerate, prejudice and discrimination. So how did these come out in the novel? And when they find that there are 5 black people that were killed, it just seems that he was the only one that pretty much cared.
Well, he wasn't the only one who cared,
yeah,
but he was the only one who was in any position to do anything about
yeah
it. For example, there was an old farmer who came to talk to him privately because he didn't want to make any waves, but he said, I appreciate what you're doing, when he pushed up against the powers that be. And mostly what I wanted to do was set up this dichotomy between Samuel, who's somebody who has a conscience, and an older man who was not much older, but, you know, a seasoned veteran of the Texas Highway Patrol, who had been there a little too long and who was very cocksure of himself, and he was a racist. And I wanted to set up a sort of dichotomy between them so that it would make it it would make Samuel have to have a crisis of what he was going to do with himself, because it was not really his job to investigate these crimes. In small-town Texas, it's either the highway patrol or more often the Texas Rangers who do investigations. And so this ranger, I mean, this highway patrolman decided that he was going to take it over. And he didn't like Samuel because Samuel was young and fresh and green. And Samuel, during the course of the novel, has to decide how, you know, whether he's going to just step back and let things take their course, which he would be perfectly justified to do, or whether he was going to fight for one of the citizens of the town that he thought had been wrongly accused.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm getting a book exactly about that. And someone's sending it to me that they've been working with. Philip Margolin called me the other day. And that's it. Yeah, I was like, oh, my God. They're supposed to be sending me Anatomy of Innocence. And it's exactly that, about people that are wrongly accused, that they finally get out of jail, and they're working with them to readjust into society and what happened to them. So the book really lends itself to what he's telling me, and I can't wait to read it. Craddock fears are realized when citing dubious evidence, Sutherland arrests Trulie Bennett, a black man that he knows and respects. Why does he decide that he's going to uncover the leads and point in another direction? And he's going to make a statement as a lawman, but will he turn a blind eye and allow him to fall? That's the problem. So Trulie was arrested, and just like other police forces today, they get their eyes on one guy and then they don't look at anybody else, and they weren't going to look at anybody else. So why does,
you know,
why does Sam decide?
Let me just interrupt you with that.
Yeah.
I know it does happen, and it happens more often than it should, but I think this, the reason these things get, they get press and they get books written about them, is that they are unusual, and it's, and I think most people who go into police work do it because they want to do a good job. They're not in it to be racist. They're not in it to be corrupt.
Yeah.
And it's the corrupt ones and the racist ones that we find out about because it's not only unusual, but it's reprehensible. And that's kind of what I wanted to show here, is this man who had just settled himself in a little too easily into becoming a corrupt cop. And he was going to take, he was bigoted. There's no question about it. He really thought that he had found the right man. And there is a piece of evidence that could work in his favor of saying yes, that this man really did do it. And that's what Samuel is faced with. He's faced with this man who feels like he knows what's what, and that Samuel is young and green, doesn't know what he's doing, and he should shut up and go back to where he came from. Plus, it doesn't help that Samuel's wife is not excited about him being a police officer, which we find out about why in the course of the book. Yes.
I know. She's unfilled about anything. And so what does Trulie do for Sam? Because Trulie, I love Trulie. He's such a nice guy.
Well, we've met Trulie in the later novels
as an
older guy, and we know that he's very competent at what he does. He is, I wouldn't call him a cow whisperer, but he knows about cattle. He, even at his young age of 18, he knows how to do things. He's very competent. He repairs fences and builds sheds and does things for Samuel that someone could say they're going to do, and then they don't show up or whatever, but Trulie is a stand-up guy. He comes when he says he's going to come. He does what he says he's going to do. He's quiet, and he behaves himself. So, you know, Samuel knows that he's a man he can trust, and he just doesn't believe that it would be possible for him to do this horrible crime.
Well, when he approaches Sutherland and asks him why he doesn't look any further, he gets his back up, doesn't he?
Yeah. Sutherland doesn't like to be told what to do by this young greenhorn. And, you know, it's a lot of men of position don't like to be told what to do with young people. I don't blame them. I don't either. I wouldn't like a young person coming to me and saying, you know, I don't like the way you do your books. You should do them this way.
I know. Neither would I. But then they can't help it. and I've got a whole group. What can I tell you? No, they don't tell me what to do. It's just that when I retired from teaching and became a book reviewer and talk show host and stuff, they just look at me and I go like, oh, is that a job? I go, no, of course I'm doing nothing all day. They don't realize that that it's a meaningful job, that I'm helping authors, that I'm reviewing books. That's not easy to make sure that you get it right. And everybody, I will be hosting the review for this book right after with 27 stars, so you don't have to worry about that on all my sites. So in case anybody's wondering, I always post a review after the show just so that they, get tempted to read more. And what I find is that after I post my review on Just Reviews, everybody reads it.
Oh, that's very comments. Cool.
Yeah, they do. I get comments all the time, and I don't tolerate any negative ones, so I just delete them. But I very rarely get anything that's negative. So tell us about the fire and who owns the land, because this was not this is a suspicious fire.
Yes, it was a suspicious fire. It was a new construction in a woods that's owned by a family that owns a tremendous amount of property, and the family doesn't live in town. And so Samuel has to call the owner and say, did you know this property was here? And they at first say that they don't know that it was there. And he runs into a very suspicious couple of guys who are looking over this burned out property, and one of them says, I'm the owner of this. And he says, well, how can he be the owner if it's on this property that belongs to these other people, and one thing leads to another. I don't know if you're aware of this, but this story is based on a real thing that happened.
I read that in your notes. Yes, I did. I did.
Yeah. And my mother died a few years ago, and I found the clippings from this event in her belongings. I had heard about it, but I really hadn't thought much about it. And when I found these clippings, I was mesmerized. It happened later in the 90s. And unlike in the book, the people who were killed in this horrible crime, they were black, but they were very well thought of in the community. The woman was if not a teacher, she worked for the school district. It was children who were killed along with her, and it was a very different circumstance. The people in the community were absolutely horrified and outraged and upset, and it was a very different scene from the one that I do in the book. So I said it earlier in order to make a different kind of story out of it, but I think you might have read then, if you read my chat about it, that the man who was accused of it was freed by the Innocence Project back about 5 years ago. And he had been in jail for 18 years for it, and he did not do it. And I already had this in my mind that I was going to make this a showcase of somebody who was innocent who had been accused. And that was, it was just amazing to me that this had happened in real life.
Yeah, it does. And it happens more often than we even know. And I often wonder something. You said something before about the media. You're right. But sometimes the media forces people, the police, to do things in a way. So they get somebody to convict of the crime. And the sad part is that each station gives you their own slant. I mean, each station's giving their own slant on the weather today, too. So you never know who to... I mean, seriously, they keep saying it's going to stop, and it's not stopping, people. It's keep going.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When Sam finally checks out the fire and the crime scene and realizes that several people are dead as a result of this senseless fire, what does he decide to do?
Well, he doesn't decide right away. I mean, because the highway patrol steps in and says, this is our job, get out. And he sort of thinks about what to do. But then, okay, so this is the part of the book that I absolutely love. This is one of my favorite characters I've ever written. When my grandfather when I was a young girl, in this town where my grandfather lived that Jarrett Creek is based on, there was a newspaper in town. And I thought, why not bring that newspaper back and make the newspaper reporter a fierce woman? Because I remember the days when reporters were really, really after the truth, and they were fiercely excited about their job. They worked very hard as journalists, and I think they still do, but there's a whole different feel to journalism now than there used to be. And I wanted her to be that kind of person. And she challenges Samuel Craddock and says, yeah, you knew it. You know, you don't have to work on this at all. You don't have to be concerned about it. It's not really your job. So go for it. You know, sit back if you want to. And it gets his back up. You know, he doesn't like it because this woman has challenged him. So he really has to think about what he's going to do. Is he going to just do what she says and just kind of let it drift? Or is he going to... And then he doesn't know what's going to happen if he does decide to step in and do some investigating, because he could get his hand slapped. So
he seems to have like an innate, you know, understanding, even though he might not have done anything or never done, worked on a case like this. He just seems to have that. He just seems to know what to do. And some people just, you know, have this skill to just know what they're supposed to do, even though they're not even sure. So the Highway Patrol takes over, not the Texas Rangers, and they discount the fact that he has the ability to solve the case. And at the same time, his wife doesn't want him to take it. Mm-hmm. She wants him to give up. So how do you describe, he's had the relationship with the Highway Patrol and his relationship with his wife. So how did that all interplay? And, of course, we were talking about Bonnie before, and oh, I love her.
Oh, I do too. She's, like I said, she's one of my favorite characters.
Yes, how did
it interplay? Well, he knew that his wife really didn't want him to take this job, and it kind of surprised him, but he took it anyway. And then, of course, now that he's got this big case, he realizes during the course of it that she's frightened for him because somebody doesn't want this case to be handled, and then there's the whole drug element, and she is afraid of that, and she also has her other reasons for not wanting him to do it. And as far as the Highway Patrol is concerned, oh, I have to tell you a funny story. Okay, so the man who is the Highway Patrolman, John Sutherland, is a real person. He had his name drawn out of a number of people who gave to a charity with the idea of getting their name in a book. You know, I did this whole thing in West Virginia where they were auctioning off a name in my book for charity. So he won. And I asked him if he wanted to be a villain or if he wanted to be a good guy. He said, oh, villain. So I said, okay, you got it. You're a real villain. And in the end, he loved it. He thought it was very well drawn. He was very excited about it. John Sutherland is a man who I think very well represents the racism that not only existed but still exists and is alive and well. Not just in Texas. Now, I'll tell you the interesting thing about this. In the town that this is set in, there was less racism than a lot of other small towns. And I have no idea why this is, but, I mean, there was certainly racism. But there, it was a small town that just seemed to be more able to accept each other. And in small towns, one of the things that happened, this is that if you get to know someone, whatever their color of their skin, people tend to be integrated more easily. Then, you know, the outsider may come in with a different color skin and they're immediately suspect, but if you know someone, you know them. So I wanted that whole aspect to come out, that there were people who knew Truly Bennett and they weren't going to fight for him, but they didn't think that he had, you know, they didn't know whether he was capable of doing something like this. And then I also added the element of the rabble-rouser from Houston, which, honestly, this is one of those characters who just stepped in on his own. I didn't intend for him to be there. And the next thing I knew, there he was. And I'm glad he came.
Yeah, me too, let me tell you. So let's get back to our girl reporter. She's Bonnie, and she gets underfoot. I think Sam wants to slam dunk her and put her somewhere. Mm-hmm. Because she's outspoken and she doesn't stop until she gets him to agree to work
exactly.
with her. So what does he agree and what happens when she keeps showing up? It's a riot.
Well, she gets her foot in wherever she wants to go. And she, in a way, teaches him how to be brash. Because she's not going to take no for an answer. When they go to the local courthouse to find out where Truly is being kept, she just marches right in. They say, you can't go in there. And she says, watch me. She just goes in wherever she wants to. And Samuel is just, I mean, I don't know whether he would have done that on his own. But to have a mentor who's older than he is, but only by about 10 years, and whom he admires, he likes her, but he doesn't like the way she treats him because she treats him like somebody who's not a man of courage, and it makes him find his courage. So that's how that plays out. He sees her courage, and he says, wait a minute, I've got some courage in there too.
Well, we've got another character that belongs to Truly. So who is Bennett Penny, and how does he come into play related to the crime? And why does Sam want to go find him? And why is he so hard to find? He doesn't want to be found, that's for sure.
Well, the thing is that he doesn't really live in the town. He lives, first of all, he was living in San Antonio, and then he moved to Houston. And his name is Beaumont Penny. And his family still lives in town. And in a way, this is sort of, I set this up. I did not intend to do this, but in the end I realized I'd set up a showcase between two different families. Samuel's family, who was ne'er-do-wells, who raised a man who turned out to be an upright person, and a family who was hardworking, quiet, kept to themselves, and they raised three sons, and one of them turned out to be a bad guy. I just thought that was an interesting contrast that I came up with, even though I didn't really intend to.
That is interesting.
So, yeah. So that was Beaumont Penny. I don't know what more you want me to say about him.
No,
I thought he was an
interesting
character too.
Yep, he was. And when you meet him in person, you'll find out why. So, why does Chili's father and family think that Sam is wasting his time? And tell us about his sister Alva and why the note she felt guilty about his arrest, about her brother's arrest.
Oh, well, the Bennett family thinks he's wasting his time because they have no faith whatsoever in the justice system.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question about the sister Alva?
Alva got a note, and wrote a note.
Yes.
And why does she feel it was her fault that he got arrested?
I think just because she had that note, and the police asked her about it, and she couldn't really, it was an innocent reason that she had the note, but it looked very suspicious at the time.
Mm. So let's bring in the guy that owns the land. Who is George Cato? And tell us about the two men involved in the real estate scam. That was really good. And what research did you do into learning about real estate scams? Because I'll tell you what, if anybody reads the book, they'll figure out how to do it. No, seriously.
Well,
you know, I often wonder sometimes when they read these books about terrorists or whatever, and who's reading it is going to follow the directions. But if you want to know a real estate scam, this is a really good one. So how did you come up with that?
I'm not sure. It's interesting how these things come into books. I'm working on another book now, and the same thing is happening.
Good.
I sort of am confronted with the way characters are behaving, and then I have to say, now, wait a minute. What happened here? And you just keep weaving it and thinking about it, and character, you know, you keep going with the characters doing certain things, and then you say, oh, that would be an interesting reason for doing that. As for real estate, I spent a few years being a realtor because I wanted more time to write. Yes, I was working in the computer field, and I was always working such long hours, and I said, you know, maybe if I were a realtor, I could make my own time. Well, ha, ha, ha. That was a lot.
Right?
But I did learn a lot about real estate there. Now, I don't recall ever having any real scams, but it's easy enough to think up scams if you've got a nefarious mind, and most criminal writers do have nefarious minds.
Yeah, I'm beginning to learn that. I'm learning a lot, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Well, who were the most vocal people in Jarrett County, and tell us why the chief of Bobtail worked with Sam and made sure that Truly was safe in jail. I felt better that I know he wasn't going to get killed. Because in prison,
well,
you just never know what's going to happen.
The sheriff of Bobtail County, I mean, I make reference to this, but I don't make a big deal about it. I make reference to another black man being murdered in jail, and this happening in East Texas. This was, I'm sure, it's probably happened, but I didn't refer to any specific incident. It was just something I thought would make the sheriff more likely, no matter what his thoughts about this, he doesn't want this to happen in his jail. You know, he doesn't want anybody being killed in his jail. You never really get the sense one way or the other of whether he's a bigot, of whether he's a racist, or whether he's just trying to protect his own reputation as the sheriff. And I did that intentionally. I wanted him to be a normal stand-up guy, you know, somebody who wants everything to go along well. If push came to shove, we have no idea how he would react. But he is, by golly, going to make sure that his jail is safe. And, you know, until he can get truly moved out of his jail, he doesn't want anything to happen to him. At the same time, we can see when Samuel goes to visit Truly in jail that there are dangers. And, you know, somebody in the jail cell next to him is a real racist, and Samuel sees that played out right there. You know, the jailer has no interest in keeping Truly safe. And so, in a way, Samuel is happy when Truly gets moved to a larger jail because he's not quite so accessible. But he sees it's a way of showing that Samuel is right to step in and be worried about Truly's life because it's a real problem. It's a real thing that happens, that someone is right there next to him who's perfectly okay with killing him. With killing Truly.
I agree, and the scary part is I've read a lot of books about prisons and prison guards, and the scary part is that not all of them, because you're not going to make a general statement, but most of them don't really care. And some of them even get paid off by some of the bad guys to beat up somebody that they want to take care of, or it's a snitch or something like that. And
well,
even though
again,
you're supposed to be safe, it's scary. It's scary.
Well, my feeling is that, again, as with any other job, that most people want to do the right thing. Most people are fine with doing the right thing. We don't know what most people will do if push comes to shove, but most people, you know, don't want anybody to be killed on their watch. They don't want anything bad to happen. So, you know, that's my feeling about it, is that what we're talking about is that outlier that's not a good person.
Yeah, I know. That's scary. So then they come after Sam, and they make threats about Sam, and they don't want him to congeal, but thank God he's got his backbone. And what did someone want Truly to pay for the crime that he didn't commit? And what I really like is that the story is told through several viewpoints. Sam in the first person, then we hear Bonnie's voice, and we hear the voices of the people in the town. So why did they threaten him, and how did you decide to present all of these voices, which made it clearer and it made it easier to follow and made it more interesting, because you wanted to know what everybody thought?
Well, when you write first person, it's, you know, you've only got one person's viewpoint. So other people have to talk to him. And in my later novels, I have a character named Loretta Singletary, who is
her.
The voice of the town. I do too. I love her. She's the voice of the town. She's a gossip, and she comes to Samuel with the things people are thinking in town and what's going on, and warning him of things, and it's kind of that's a voice that you can hear besides Samuel's. And I didn't have that in this book because he doesn't know Loretta at that time, although I do give her a tiny little part in the book just because I couldn't stand not to
have her. I missed her. I go, like, where's Loretta to guide him and set him straight?
Well, that was it. She doesn't really set him straight, but she is the voice of the town, and she's able to give him little bits of gossip that he might not otherwise be able to come in on his own, because I think it's unrealistic to have a single person who knows everything. And if you have multiple points of view, or if you're doing a if you're doing a past tense telling of a story, but I'm telling it every story through his eyes in the moment, and so I have to have other voices who will come in and be strong enough to talk to him and to bring other points of view in.
I agree. That was interesting. So Noah is back to his wife. What would Jean want him to do? And why did they often go their separate ways? She went to her mother, or she went out, she went somewhere else. Why didn't Sam see his mother, and why was she so negative to him? And that bothered me, because he's a wonderful person, and I wanted to, you know, have a word with her.
Why? I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Why is his mother negative to him?
Why would Jean want him to, what would Jean want him to do? And she didn't want him to go, they often went their separate ways. And why did Sam never went to see his mother? He never went to visit her.
Sam did go and visit his own mother. He didn't go and visit, in this book, he didn't go and visit Jean's mother, but he does
Jean's
go
Jean's mother,
and visit.
Yeah, she was negative towards him, I know.
No, Jean's mother was fine with him. Jean's mother lives in Dallas, and she was fine with Samuel. He likes her just fine. He just didn't happen to go there in this book because there were reasons why he was doing other things, and he wanted... You know, he said, this is a chance for you to go visit your mother. Because what people don't understand about Texas, growing up there, is something I understand, is that is people will drive 4 hours not thinking a minute about it. You know, she drives to Dallas, which is about a four-hour drive away. People just, Texas is so big that people will jump in the car and drive somewhere. My parents used to call me and they'd say, we're going to run over to Louisiana for lunch. And say, well,
oh,
I have to lunch tomorrow because it takes all day to drive there. And people just don't think anything about it. I used to jump in the car when I lived in Colorado. I would jump in my car at 6:30 in the morning, and I'd be in Dallas by, you know, 10:30 that night. Because, you know, you just drive these long distances, you think nothing about it. So people say, you know, if you say they go their separate ways, just because they're driving a long distance doesn't mean that they're separate. You know, they talk on the phone, and this is just, you know, what was happening around this case. There was no intention for them to be separate. And as for Samuel's mother, I mean, I think you see in the book that Samuel's mother was a piece of work.
Yeah, so I meant, she is a serious piece of work, I know.
Yeah.
So what was then we've got Horace and Donna. They're another pieces of work, and Tom.
Yeah.
And well, Tom, we see in later books too, so he gets a better role. But
yes.
Horace and Donna, and Horace, the sister's Donna, and they're not exactly the best couple in the world. So why does Tom jump at the chance of staying with Sam and Jeannie? And she loves it.
Well, he jumps at the chance because they treat him like they really care about him. And his parents do care about him, but they care about other things as well, and they're just not good people, you know. I don't know. I somehow liked Donna. I don't know why I liked her. I just did. I thought that she was kind of in a bad situation. She had married Horace, and Horace is not a good guy, and Horace has his reasons for not being a good guy too. You know, they're just not. They're not strong people. They're people who take the easy way out, and I think that's another contrast I wanted to make between. Between Horace and Truly Bennett. I mean, Horace takes the easy way out every time. And Truly's not going to ever do that. It's just not who he is. You know, I'm not intending to write a psychological novel about why people are the way they are, but I do like to make contrast between the way people behave in the world and the way decisions that they make. And Horace makes decisions that show who he is as a person.
Well, he leaves, and Sam thinks that Horace is into something he shouldn't be into, and he thinks he's mistreating Donna. And then Tom is left high and dry because nobody knows where they went. You don't tell him anything.
Exactly. And, you know, I tried to show that Donna really did not want to do that, but, you know, she goes along with what Horace wants to have done. She's just not a strong person. And, so, I mean, that's what that story is that she's not strong. They go off, and I know Horace does care about his son, but he has a pride about wanting to to get, he wants to be able to provide for his family, but he doesn't know good ways to do it.
Mm. There are a lot of people like that, unfortunately. But before
I think so.
I don't want to forget, tomorrow at 11, I'm going to be interviewed, believe it or not, by Marcia Casper Cook on A Good Story Is a Good Story. And I don't know what she's going to talk about. We're going to probably talk about book reviews and some other stuff. And my publisher, Robin from Fidelity, is going to be on the show too, I think. It's going to be at 11. It should be hilarious. It should be a lot of fun. So that's A Good Story Is a Good Story with Marcia Casper Cook at 11. On Thursday, I'm going to interview the author of Stolen. And on the 21st, I'm so excited, Anthony France and The Outsider. That was, oh, my God, that book is fantastic.
Ooh, I have to write that down.
Yeah, that is a legal thriller that is unbelievable. And on the 23rd, former roller derby star Tim Patton, who actually I remember from the San Francisco Bay Area Bombers, and he did own part of the team, wrote a story called My Kill Play, and it's about what happens when AIDS hits the roller derby stars, including himself, and how he dealt with it. On the 27th, Carl Brookins will be there. He's a riot with the case of the missing stolen case. And on the 30th, A-Tone for Ivory Cloud with Jeffrey Wells. And that's just March. We've got a whole lot more coming up in May and in April. But the exciting part in May is on May 9th at 10, I'm going to interview the head writer of Murder, She Wrote, Tom Sawyer. And that should be interesting. That's just some of what I'm up to. There's a lot more. So
you're a busy woman.
I'm very busy. And like my brother says to me, why don't you get paid? I said, that was the fun of doing my job for fun, for having fun. No, I don't get paid to do reviews, and I don't get paid for the radio show. And thanks to Partners in Crime, Cheryl, Gina, and Wendy, they keep me very busy. As a matter of fact, when they say that they're having a book tour, they don't ask me if I want to join. They just automatically send the book and
don't care
what it is. Yeah, I get them on my mind. Cheryl does the same thing, so don't worry about that. So who is Willis, and why does he agree to help Sam, and who are the other connections in the other police forces and the ranges? Because he finally gets a little bit of cooperation from the other places.
Well, this was... You know, as a writer, you make decisions not always based on how you think the story is going to go along, but for strategic reasons. Later on in the later books, Luke Shoppy is a man who shows up in a few of the books. He's a Texas Ranger and has been for a long time. And I thought, you know, why not show how Samuel met Luke Shoppy and make both of them be green people in the... world of investigation, and Luke Shoppy is working with Willis, and Willis just turns out to be a guy who is a good guy. You know, he is willing to help Samuel. He sees the talent in Samuel. He sees that Samuel is an upright person, and although he can't really interfere because it would just go against everything that he knows to interfere with the investigation, because the Texas Highway Patrol has said they'll take it, and the Texas Rangers only comes in if they're asked. They can't walk in and say, we're going to take over this investigation because you're not doing a good job. And then he has other reasons for not wanting to take over as well. So he wants to help Samuel, so he gives Luke Shoppy the opportunity to help Samuel if Samuel needs any help. And, of course, Samuel and Luke do work together to a certain extent. So that's what that was about. He came in more as a vehicle for getting Luke in, and then he became a person in his own right, a character in his own right. It's amazing how characters step up and become more than you thought they were going to be.
Now, before I ask some of the questions about the cover and the title, this really got me, because I read another incident about that when I was reading another book yesterday. I just finished Cold Blood by Kurt Cam, about vampires and goths and autopsies and a guy that just became a paramedic and he was really into this girl was killed and her foot was missing, and he went after the person to get the foot back even though she died. So this is like a bad autopsy. So why did Sutherland do everything to prevent Sam from continuing on the case, and what happens when he sends him to view the autopsies? That was brave, and lots of Vicks vapor rub so that you don't smell it. Oh, God.
Oh. Here's what's so crazy. My husband was a doctor. He retired a number of years ago because he wanted to do research full-time. But he read the book, and I said, what did you think of the autopsy scene? I said, you know, I've never seen an autopsy. And he said, I never even thought about it. He said, it seems absolutely real. And what I did was I went online, and I looked up autopsies of burn victims, and there were photos of them. And my imagination went on from there. And I also read about the old ways of doing autopsies in, you know, back in the 80s. And as it happened, they had just moved to move the autopsies in Austin to a new facility. Now, the reason I wanted Samuel to go there is that I wanted to show, there's a certain feeling I have that in death, people are more equal than they ever will be. Everyone is the same when they're dead. And that was sort of what I wanted to put, to sort of show that, is that Samuel goes to this autopsy, and it doesn't matter what color somebody is. You're looking at an autopsy, and they're gone. And although that's never stated explicitly, it's an implicit thing. The other thing is that I didn't really want, you know, I'm hoping that it wasn't too didactic for me to have Sutherland not want Samuel in the case. It was more like Samuel to him was like a fly buzzing around. He just wanted to give him trouble. He wasn't really saying, I don't ever want you to around. He didn't want him around, but not because he thought Samuel was going to do anything, but because it was like having a fly around, you know, get out of here, scram, shoo. And so he sent him off on this autopsy thinking, oh, you know, he'll knuckle under there. You know, he's not going to be able to handle this autopsy. And, of course, Samuel can handle an autopsy because he has to. You know, that's just, you know, his code is that he has to do what he has to do.
So he has his reaction, and then I think that's pretty much almost what cinches the fact that he wants to do the job, even though Gene doesn't really want him to. But there's another case in this book. Tell us about I've come in contact with as an educator, so I know. Tell us about the drug problem in the school and about Charlie and his father. And every time he does something to sell drugs, he gets defended. And what is the principal? What he wants to have him sacked. And his father puts pressure on him, but he doesn't want him to pay the consequences. And how true is that? Yeah, very.
Well, there was so much that went into that particular interplay because I have a son who's now 30, but when he was in school, I got to see all kinds of parents and the way they behave toward their kids. And some parents, it doesn't matter what their kid does, they're going to defend them and they're going to say they're good people. Other parents, not so much. And that fascinates me because some of the people whose parents defended them to the death turned out to be sort of ne'er-do-wells. And then some of the ones whose parents, you know, say no matter what they do, they're not right. Some of those kids turn out to be okay. So it's just, you know, it's just an oddity to me. And here's this man who is a booster of the high school football team. And poor Charlie plays football, and he's not built for it. And so that's it, is that the football is king in Texas. and so the principal of the school doesn't want Charlie to be punished because he doesn't want the high school quarterback to be suspended from school. And the dad is one of these dads who my son can do no wrong. He's a wronged kid. You know, the system is not doing well by him. We don't see a lot of that. The crazy thing is I actually like Charlie. You know, he was a funny kid. He's not a good kid, But he's not a bad kid either. He's still being formed as a human being. And you can see that his dad is not doing him any favors. And Samuel is having none of it. He's not, you know, he's not interested in the dad puffing himself up and storming around and saying so. That's what that was about. That was another. It's interesting because that's another parent-child relationship that I was showing, and none of this was actually intentional. But that sort of was throughout the book. There were a lot of these kind of parent-child things. You know, it was Samuel's parents and him as a child, Beaumont Penny and his parents, and then Charlie and his dad. And I couldn't stand his dad, but I liked Charlie. You know, I thought he was a...
And then there's Tom and his parents. And I wonder
and
what
Tom
happened.
And his parents. Yeah,
as Tom
exactly.
and Charlie met, and Tom straightened Charlie out. That would be really cool.
Yeah.
Get him. So when he threatens to arrest him and lets him know he won't tolerate his selling drugs, Charlie could care less, and there's no consequences from his father.
Exactly.
And, I mean, as an educator for a million years... you come up against friends like that.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
It takes every ounce out of you to convince them that they need to listen to what you're saying and they need to do something for their child. And when they said to me, because I was a dean, that you're not going to suspend them, I said, try me. Oh, I did.
Exactly.
They got it. You know, I got a lot of respect. I mean, don't even attempt.
Well, eventually
it
the principal has to knuckle under because when it's very clear that Charlie has done this. I mean, he has no recourse except to suspend Charlie. So, you know, it's not that he wants to. It's just that that's the way it has to be.
Yeah, you have no choice sometimes. And I remember vividly, as said, we had a group of kids that were difficult when I was the dean, a group of boys, and they would listen to me, but they wouldn't listen to their teacher. And at the end of the year, the principal of my school, and unfortunately for the children, she's still there because she doesn't really care, and she's not very strong, and the kids, there's no respect at all. And I said to her, these 10 boys have been bringing weapons. I had to call the police on several on the weekend that you made me call, which had nothing to do with me in the school. I said, I am going to suspend them from graduation. I said, unless I see a turnaround in the last 6 to 8 weeks, they're not attending. They're going to sit in the back of the auditorium. I don't care. Or they could stay home. I said, but I've been putting myself on the line and doing things. And what happened was 5 of them straightened out, and the other 5 were suspended from graduation. So, and she didn't want to tell the parents, but I did. And I said, you can bring them to sit in the back of the auditorium, but they cannot attend because they don't deserve it because their grades were poor. They should have been held over, but they were held over before. I said, and you have to stand your ground. So Sam finally uncovers, and this is just a shock, we're not going to say who it is, uncovers who's selling the drugs and who's in charge. How did you come up with that? That was really like, whoa.
You know, I can't stand the woo-woo part of writing, but that's what that was. It just is. That's what the characters did. And, you know, I know that I am driving it at some point, but it seemed like the way this unfolded was just the way it had to be, you know, because as I'm writing along and I see the characters behaving in certain ways, I realize that's what it has to be. It's like the book I'm working on now. I could not figure out what exactly had happened. And I keep writing and writing and writing and saying, okay, at some point you have to know exactly what happened. And then suddenly I realize that I have formed something that to me becomes obvious that this has to be the way it happened. It's a plot, but in another way it's just the natural progression of the way characters behave.
Well, Sam pieces it all together. And when he finally does it, he has a revelation moment, and he realizes that he is the best man for the job, and he really is the best man for the job. So how do we know that someone close to Sam is on the drug deal, and then when a girl overdoses, he's about had it, but Charlie doesn't care? And yet maybe in his heart he does, but he doesn't know how to show he cares.
I think that Charlie at that moment is shocked. He doesn't really. I mean, that was sort of the way I felt about it, is that Charlie is not yet a bad guy. He might eventually be a bad guy, but right now he's a kid, and kids don't always know what the consequences of their actions are. And I think that's exactly what's happened with Charlie, is that he doesn't know, he doesn't realize how things can have consequences. And I even thought it was an interesting thing about the girl who overdoses and almost dies. I thought the relationship with her parents was interesting. You know, it was they obviously cared about her. And you get some sort of sense in that, that they may not have always given her the kind of attention she needs. Or they may have given her plenty of attention, and she is, like many teenagers, just not willing to accept that something bad can happen to her.
A lot of times, the parents don't see, they see what they want to see, but
sure,
they don't see anything.
Oh, believe me, when my son was in high school, it amazed me the number of people would say to me, "Oh, I'm so glad my child doesn't drink," and I'm thinking, "Oh, yes, they do. You just don't know."
I know. You know, it's funny because my brother came to visit the other day with my nephew, and he was drinking iced tea. He doesn't drink at all in college. He's a designated driver. And
now, my son was too in high school. Yeah,
he won't. He doesn't drink. He doesn't even drink beer, which is good. Does he do other things? I don't ask questions anymore. But is he a straight-A student and graduating in May? Yeah, he is. He's graduating with a degree in finance from Stetson, and he's an A student, so that's all we care about. And he's an interesting kid. But what kind of help does Charlie need? And why didn't the principal back up Sam? I mean, this kid really needs, and his father is so powerful. So do you mean to say, and I'm sure it happens in real life because you see it on the news too, the father is very powerful, he's rich, he's a big, you know,
that he's powerful, he thinks he's powerful, but
thinks
this
he's powerful,
is small towns we're talking about. He's a lawyer in a small town, and therefore he has some status, but his power is mostly in blustering. You know, he just goes in and says, you know, not my kid. This is not going to happen to my kid. And the reason the principal doesn't back Samuel up, there are two reasons. Number one, this principal still remembers Samuel as a kid who went to high school there. And he does not think of Samuel as a person who is really the chief of police. I mean, he doesn't accept that Samuel has a role there. That's number one. And, you know, it's not that he dislikes Samuel or anything. He just does. He just dismisses him. You know, he's sort of, you know, not in his world. And then the second thing is that that Samuel is trying to pin this on a guy who is the quarterback of the high school football team, and they certainly don't want that to happen. To have him out of the game, because that might hurt their chances of a championship. So that's always
always
plays very large in any Texas
team. I know. It's like you don't want to lose, and you want that trophy, and you want the prestige, and you want your kids to get something out of it. And, of course, they're all thinking that the scouts are going to come and they're going to be on the next NFL team. You never know.
Here's the thing, is that one of what the father says is, you know, I'm the one who provides the bus for these kids to go to these out-of-town games, and I can take that away. And Samuel says, you know, parents have driven their kids in the past, and they can do it again.
And if he wanted to, he could foot the bill too, so it doesn't really matter.
That's not part of this. That's later on that can happen, but he wouldn't do it anyway because he doesn't believe in using power that way.
No, well, my mother used to drive my brother and the baseball team to the games too. Nobody had a bus, people, back then. You just took your kids and whatever. And I got to take 7 buses to college, and I didn't have a chauffeur like they do today.
Exactly.
I mean, really, seriously. So before we end, we have about 5 more minutes. I just want to make an announcement. I'm very excited, and I just hope it works out. My nephew Rob Miller is running for commissioner of District C in Coconut Creek, Florida. And the election is today, so you need change, as they say, and he's young and he's smart. and he cares about overcrowded classrooms and water resources and road construction and all the things that Coconut Creek needs. So the polls are opened at 7 this morning, so you should just go out there and vote for him because he's really great. And I know that he can do the job the right way. And I promised him I would announce it because I'm a good answer.
Well, good
now,
for
besides
you.
The fact that he's really smart. If I didn't think he was really good for the job, I wouldn't say so because I'm just not going to, you know, give my endorsement to just anybody. But he's really amazing, and he's got the right idea. And I listened to some of his interviews, and he's really comes off great. And at this point, I think they need a new change, a new view, and a new younger outlook. So this is the prequel to all of them. So where is Samuel going next? What's next for him?
Well, it's funny. I was at the Tucson Festival of Books this weekend, and a woman in the audience asked me, I was on a panel, and she asked me, is Samuel going to do another prequel, or is he going to go back to the way the present day? And I have no plans to do any more with the prequel. I feel like I did that. I got it out of my system, and I like working with Sam in the present day, and that's what I'm doing. And she said, oh, good. So that's what's going to be happening, is that Samuel, I have the next book. It's called A Reckoning in the Backcountry, and it's I'm supposed to turn it in June 1st, although the plotting I'm doing, I'm plotting along, and I'm hoping I'll get there by June 1st, but, you know, it takes some time.
And, of course, I'm going to hound Cheryl until she sends me a copy before it comes out.
Great.
So that I could read it and tell everybody how wonderful it is.
Cheryl is my publicist. She's terrific.
Yes, she is great. And let me tell you, what's even greater is that, you know, I saw something by Scott Turow the other day, and I emailed somebody, and they said, oh, you'll be on the list for the final copy. And I know Daniel Silver's coming out with another one, sequel to The Black Widow, which was absolutely 600 pages of I Couldn't Put It Down. It was fantastic, and I'm getting that. And I said to my brother, I may not get paid, but I have so much fun, and I can get to read anything I want.
You know, I'm reading a book right now. I'm going to be on a panel at Left Coast Crime this weekend, and I'm reading a book by a woman I never read, and I'm just thinking, why is she not famous? She's a wonderful writer. It's amazing how many writers you can read. This is R. Franklin James. She's just amazing. Never heard of her?
No, I saw that on Facebook, and I was going to say, why doesn't she send me the book to read?
I'll tell her.
Yeah. I do that ever so often. There's a paranormal book that came out by Susan Denard, and just for fun, I wrote, oh, you know, I read teen books, and I review them, and I got two of them yesterday.
Oh, my.
I go like, and I have a pile inside of 35 that are sitting on the arm of my chair, as opposed to the 10 that are on my table and the 20 that are underneath. I'm getting down.
Well,
we
writers really appreciate reviewers. You know, I know it's a hard job.
It's just not easy because, you know, there are a lot of people. I post my reviews and they stand as rated and written. And ever so often somebody will say, and I don't put spoilers in. At least I don't think I do. And I always send the publicist or somebody else a copy of the review in case I don't see a mistake here or there, because I don't read on my computer, which explains why Fran doesn't do Kindle or ebook. It has to be a real book so that I could destroy it and circle and underline, which is great.
Well,
I
have to say, Kindle books are real books too.
Yeah,
you can call them paper books.
I like paper books, and besides, you get more royalties for the paper books, everybody. Besides the point that they are better. I was announced MJ Magazine. MJ9 is my magazine. That if you'd like to write any articles on publishing, writing, or stories or anything, I'm working on MJ10, and it's going to come out probably in May or June. It's for readers, writers, authors, student writers, anybody that wants to write about any issue in publishing or writing, book reviews, or want to speak out on anything in the news and issues. I would love that. So MJ9 came out 2 weeks ago on Amazon, and it's MJ is after my sister who died, Marcia Joyce. And the network, MJ Network, is after her too. Yeah, she conned me into doing this, and I think I keep her alive and in my mind and remind myself every time I do a book review, I say it's your fault.
That's a wonderful tribute.
Yeah, she dared me to review a cookbook, and as everyone knows, I don't know one end of a stove from the other. I can't even tell you. I had a I had a date once and he asked me to make him something and I didn't realize I turned the oven on self-clean and oh well. Yeah, seriously. And I couldn't open it up. And then when I opened it up, the meatloaf was gray. And I said, well, either I could, you know, just skirt off and put it on the sauce. No, I called the pizza place. He never knew the difference. It didn't matter. I mean, it was hilarious. And I reviewed a cute cookbook by Martha Cheeves, and she's still laughing. And she posted it everywhere. And after that, it just snowballed. Seriously.
Oh, that's terrific. That's terrific.
And then I have, you know, then I met you with the Philippist, and that was great too. That was by accident. I'm going, this is
really
so cool. Yeah, are you gonna come again this year?
And to where?
To the Thriller Fest.
You know what? I am not coming to Thriller Fest this year. I have a couple of things that I have to do, and I just realized that it was just it was one thing too many. And I've been the last 3 years, and I thought, okay, you can skip that this year. Yeah.
Well, if John Land invites me, I'll probably come.
Well,
because,
good.
I like the panels, to be very honest.
I love going there, but you know that you have to sort of eventually relegate your time and money, and I'm already having to go back to the East Coast for something else, and then I'm going to Left Coast Crime, and then I'm going to Toronto in the fall, and I just said, you know what, you have to stop something. So that's the one that gets dropped this year.
I can understand. I'm lucky. I only have to pay for the hotel.
Mm. Well, you are lucky.
I don't have to.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are. They send me as a media because I do all these everything for free. So they pay for that part. So I only have to pay for the hotel, which is a lot of money, by the way. But
it is.
Last year,
yeah.
It's a lot of money. But last year they picked up one night. I was surprised, and that was really
nice.
Great. It was still a lot of money.
Well,
but
you know
what?
Yeah.
It was worth it.
Well, you certainly get to meet a lot of wonderful authors there, and they're so generous with their time. I mean, I remember one of them following me out to talk to me more about the question I'd asked, and I just thought, wow, it's just amazing. They really are. They care about helping writers do what they do. Yeah,
they're fantastic. But my favorite person, besides John Land, who I love, I met R.L. Stine, and I think he's great. He's so great.
Oh, he is terrific. He's got such a good sense of humor.
Yeah, he is. He's great. And I was honored. I don't know if he read it, but he took a copy of my last book, Hidden Truths and Lies, told from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone that did something wrong. So I don't know if he read it, but he did take it. And he made me sign it. I thought that was, you know, whether he read it or not, I just was so touched. I said, okay, good, this is so cool. So before we end, where could everybody find out more about you besides the fact that I see you on Facebook all the time?
I have a website, www.terryshames.com. It's easy to find.
So I want to thank you so much. And would you do me a favor and please send some of the sunshine over here? And I think
it's
taking a rest. It only looks like a little rain or sleet now. So maybe Mother Nature is taking a break, but then, I don't know, in about 10 minutes it could be really coming down again. They're expecting 2 feet of snow. I'm hoping they're wrong.
Oh, Fran, thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for doing it. And thanks, Cheryl. I'll thank her personally. And I get the next one. I can't wait to read it because this is one of my favorite characters. And you'll
I can't wait to finish writing it.
Thanks so much. And have a great day and enjoy the sunshine. Everybody have a great day. And, you know, St. Patrick's Day, you could buy some presents for people and put some shamrocks on them, and they could be books. And for those of you sitting in the snow and cold weather, take out a book and read. Have a nice day, everybody, and bye.
Bye-bye.